Is it on now?
Yeah.
Great. Okay. I'd like to thank the organizers for having me here to give this talk. And the work I'm going to talk about is joint with Van Vu and Melanie Matchett-Wood. So before I talk about polynomial Feynman isomorphisms, I'll review a little bit Feynman homomorphisms. So if we have Z and W additive groups, by which I just mean abelian groups with subsets A and B, a Feynman homomorphism of order K is a map phi from A to B that's nearly a group homomorphism. And that just means if you have two K-fold sums, like the AIs and the AI primes, then phi should respect those sums in the way that a homomorphism would. Phi is a Feynman isomorphism of order K if, first of all, it has an inverse, and that inverse matches this definition of above as well. So the inverse is also a Feynman homomorphism of order K. One application of the idea in these Feynman isomorphisms is summed up in this lemma here. If you have a finite subset of a torsion-free additive group Z, then for every K and every sufficiently large prime P, you can map A into Z mod PZ, preserving K additive properties. So there's a Feynman isomorphism of order K to Z mod PZ. And this can be convenient because if you have some combinatorics problem in this torsion-free additive group, you can send it into a finite field and do your work there. For example, to prove Feynman's theorem, the one that shows that small sum set implies a lot of additive structure, to get that in torsion-free groups, the standard thing is to map it into Z mod PZ and then complete the proof there. So the question you might have, or at least that I had at one point, is are there cases where you'd want to preserve additive and multiplicative properties at the same time? Like any question you hear in a talk, of course the answer is yes. So in the sum product problem, if you take a finite subset here, A, a subset of the integers, the sum set A plus A is just the set of all sums of elements in A, and the product set A times A, the set of all products of elements in A. The goal of the sum product problem is to show that either the sum or the product is large with respect to the cardinality of the original set A. Can we map this to Z mod P for some prime P? Well, first of all, Feynman isomorphism is not suitable because while it can preserve the additive properties, it won't preserve the multiplicative properties. Of course, you can certainly map to Z mod PZ. Just pick a gigantic P. If you pick P bigger than anything in sight, so bigger than anything in the sum or the product or the set itself, then the cardinality of A is the same as the cardinality of A where each element is taken mod P. And the cardinality of A plus A and A times A is preserved in the same way. So here you can send this, all the relevant cardinalities are put into Z mod PZ, and you could do the problem there. The question remaining is what if A were not a subset of integers, but were a subset of complex numbers? Could you still map into Z mod PZ, preserving the relevant additive and multiplicative properties? And that's going to be the topic of this talk today. So can you make this map? The answer is yes, and that will be the main theorem. So we'll take S to be a finite subset of a characteristic zero integral domain. That'll be something given to us in the problem. And L will be a finite set that we get to cook up of non-zero elements in Z bracket S. A characteristic zero integral domain, just to make sure we're all on the same page, the characteristic zero is analogous to the torsion-free condition. So it just means if you take the multiplicative identity and add it to itself over and over again, you don't get back to zero. An integral domain means commutative ring with identity and no zero divisors. All that means that it should contain an isomorphic copy of Z. So this little Z there is referring actually to the isomorphic copy of the integers living in the integral domain there. And Z bracket S is the smallest subring containing both that isomorphic copy and S itself. So given all this setup, what do we get? Well, there exists an infinite sequence of primes with positive density among all primes, such that for each P in this sequence, you can find a ring homomorphism that maps Z bracket S into Z mod PZ, all the while making sure that 0 isn't an element of the image of L. So anything in L that's non-zero remains non-zero. So some examples of characteristic zero integral domains. If you don't like saying all four of those words, you can just think complex numbers, real numbers, or integers all meet these meet the conditions. And if you just want to think of the complex numbers, that captures all the main ideas of this talk. Phi is a ring homomorphism, so it respects addition and multiplication, and will do so arbitrarily many times. So it's, in that sense, it's like a Feynman homomorphism of order k for arbitrary k, but also respecting multiplication. Also, by definition, phi of 0 is 0, phi of 1 is 1. So on the integers, this map is behaving exactly like our good old mod p map from before. And to give one example of applying this, if you were given some set S and decided to make L to be the set containing all differences of sums of elements in S, then this mapping theorem would give you a Feynman isomorphism of order 2. And the reason you get isomorphism is you could set S2 equal to S4, so that would give you injectivity on the set S, so an inverse exists. And the set L itself, if you think about it a bit, is exactly what you need to guarantee that the cardinality of S plus S is preserved. So that is the main theorem. Of course, the title is polynomial Feynman isomorphisms, and so I'll rephrase this in a polynomial version. So we'll start now with A, a finite subset of a characteristic zero integral domain D, and we'll look at a system of polynomial equations with integer coefficients, and it's important that the coefficients be integers. Anyway, our polynomials are f sub j, the variables x1 through xn. Just like in our main theorem, there exists a sequence of primes with positive density, such that for each prime p, we have this ring homomorphism from z bracket a to z mod pz that's bijective from a to its image in z mod pz, so the subset b. And the critical property here is that if you look at some n-tuple of elements in a, that's a solution. Well, if you look at this n-tuple, it's a solution to the system of polynomials, so it's a root for all these polynomials in d, if and only if phi applied to each one of these ais is also a solution to that system of polynomials in Z mod PZ. And the system in Z mod PZ, I just mean interpret all the integer coefficients mod P. So this, for example, would imply the Feynman isomorphism lemma from the first slide. If you take a single polynomial, and that polynomial is just the sum of k variables minus the quantity of the sum of k different variables, that would give you a Feynman isomorphism of order k. And to see how this comes from the mapping theorem, so the set we're given is A, that's equivalent to the S in the previous slide, and we get to pick our L, it'll be the set of all differences of elements in A, union all possible non-zero values taken by these polynomials. And that gives you this biconditional, it's a root on one side if and only if it's a root on the other side. Well, let me talk about a few applications. First of all, going back to our motivating problem, the sum product estimate. So the reason that we have some hope here is that recently there have been some progress in proving results, I guess, the sum product and other types in a finite field. So Katz and Shen, improving a result of Gerais in 2007, proved the following result, that if you take A a subset of Z mod PZ, such that A is not too large with respect to the size of the field, so it's at most root p, then there are absolute constants c and alpha, such that, so c over log a to the alpha, you can essentially not worry about too much. The important thing is you have this cardinality of a to the 14 13ths being a lower bound for the cardinality of a plus a and a times a. And this is something we could think of applying our mapping theorem to. So if you took a finite subset of a characteristic zero integral domain, you want to map it into Z mod PZ and then use the sum product estimate there. Well, we're given A, so we need to cook up L. So we might use the following L. L will be all differences of elements in A, and that will guarantee that the cardinality of A is the same as the cardinality after mapping by phi. Also, we'll include all differences of products of elements of A, so that will preserve the cardinality of A times A. And finally, all differences of sums of elements in A to preserve the cardinality of A plus A. So this preserves all the cardinalities we're interested in for this particular problem. And there's one more little bit here. You remember we have this infinite sequence of primes, and that's important because this result here requires that P is at least A squared. Luckily, we can find infinitely many primes P for which a map of this sort, of a map phi like this will exist. So we simply pick a P that's at least the square of the cardinality of A and find our map phi, applying the mapping theorem, and then, well, applying the mapping theorem puts us in G mod PZ, and then we can apply Ketz-Shen or derive or some other sum product result so long as it works for small sets in G mod PZ, and we get the following corollary. So it's the same as the Ketz-Shen bound with this 14/13th exponent, but now it works in any characteristic zero integral domain, including the complex numbers. Speaking of the complex numbers, so people have been interested in this in that context, of course. So Sholomoshi in 2005 proved in C that you can get an exponent of 14/11th, so a little bit better, and that was using some clever use of the topology in the complex plane. So you could, I mean, this corollary above maybe is interesting in that, well, the topology was useful, it wasn't necessary, and in some situation, like a p-adic situation where you had a very different topology, you could still have a similar, though maybe weaker, sum product result. Also, because we have this infinite sequence of primes, if you could prove a sum product result in Z mod PZ where you had some much stronger assumption on the size of the set, like the size of the set was at most inverse Ackermann the size of the field, who knows, something crazy like that, that would still be useful for the mapping theorem because you can always pick a prime as large as you need to meet any such condition. So it's possible maybe if we assumed instead that, well, in Ketz and Shen, they assumed that the cardinality of A was at most root P. Maybe if you assume A is much smaller, you could do better. This is an example of what I would call a black box application of the mapping theorem, where you have something in Z mod P and you get essentially the same result in a characteristic zero integral domain. And there are other things you can do like this. Bourguin, Ketz, and Tao proved a Semmering-Trotter type result in the finite field, and you can map that as well. And there's also this, I guess, growth and generation result by Helfgott in SL2 Z mod P. And I think he's going to talk about an SL3 version of that later this week. But the SL2 version, you can also map that and get a version in SL2C for the complex numbers or any other characteristic zero integral domain. And that SL3C result is actually very analogous to one proven by Michu Chang by a different method. And so it's kind of an alternate proof adapting Helfgott's, using Helfgott's result as a black box on the one hand or as Chang did using them as motivation for techniques in the complex numbers. Anyway, this next result that I'd like to talk about is an example of something that's not a black box application because there isn't really a corresponding result in Z mod P that we're just going to reference. I'll give a little bit of motivation first. So this is looking at the singular probability of discrete random matrices. So say this matrix is n by n and it has independent entries that are +1 or -1 independently with probability 1/2. Our goal is to show that the probability that this matrix is singular is not too large. This story started in 1967, where Janosz Komlosz proved that the probability was small, and later improved that, showing it was bounded above by big O of 1 over root n. In 1995, Kahn, Komlosz, and Samarady got the first exponential upper bound on the singularity probability, so 0.999 to the n. And people far before this have always expected it to be roughly 1/2 to the n. So it's getting a little closer. In 2005, Tao and Vu managed to change the middle digit from 9 to 3, so squeeze it a little tighter, and then a year later squeezed it a good bit tighter, getting down to asymptotically 3/4 to the n. And then this year, Bourguin, Vu, and myself managed to get it a little bit better using basically the same approach as Tao and Vu with one new idea. We got it down to 1 over root 2 asymptotically to the n. So it's a small bit, although it's still a square root off of what people would conjecture. The question for this talk is, could you extend this to a case where the entries aren't just integers, aren't just +1 and -1 even, but they are arbitrary complex numbers? And the issue is that the Tao-Vu approach that we were using relies, in some sense, on this identity, that the indicator function is this sort of circle method integral of e to the 2 pi I x times t. And that doesn't work if x is a complex number. This identity no longer holds. So we need some other idea to get into to prove this result. And that idea is going to be mapping it. I'll state the theorem first, though. So if we have a characteristic zero integral domain D, And M sub N is an N-band random matrix with discrete independent entries. There's one non-degeneracy condition needed, so we need to have that for any entry alpha, the maximum probability that it takes any given value is at most P. So if some entry alpha took some, like was 0 100% of the time, of course you might get singularity larger, but we're going to bound that above by some constant P. And the result we get is that M sub N is singular with probability asymptotically tending to root P to the N. And so this implies that one on the previous slide, because in the plus one, minus one case, P is 1/2. So the three ideas that I'm going to mention in the proof, the first one is how we actually use the mapping theorem. And the key here is the determinant is a polynomial. So you saw this polynomial version of the theorem, so we can map into, I'll call it Z mod capital QZ, where Q is capitalized because it is some absolutely gigantic prime, and it depends on N, but it's still finite. So we can find some huge prime and place the whole problem in Z mod QZ. That's where Tao and Vu did a lot of their proof. And in fact, we can do the entirety of the proof in Z mod QZ, but need to make some modifications and generalize it so that other values than plus one and minus one are allowed. And then finally, there's one new idea of splitting a vector in half at one point, and that splitting gives us a square root, but it improves the constant a little bit. And so this is, this is not so much a black box application, because you might wonder what would this result say in Z mod QZ, where Q is this big prime. And the problem is that if you pick some random variable in Z mod QZ, Q is depending on the size of your matrix N, and we want an asymptotic in N. So you'd actually want an infinite sequence of random variables, one for each different Q. And that maybe doesn't make, you could phrase something like that, but it really makes the most sense thinking of this in terms of a characteristic zero situation where they automatically have this way of going into Z mod Q for each large enough Q. And I guess in the remaining minute, I'll say a teeny bit about the proof of this result. So this is just restating the main mapping theorem. The general approach to build this map is going to be start in Z bracket S and map into various rings until we finally get into Z mod PZ. And then we'll let C be the composition of all those maps. And there are three main ingredients. First, the primitive element theorem, and then Hilbert's null Stellensatz. And maybe I'll say a teeny bit about how these are coming up. Basically, this S we're given at the beginning has a bunch of algebraic numbers and a bunch of transcendental numbers in it. So the null Stellensatz lets us turn all the transcendentals into algebraics, so we have a whole bunch of algebraic numbers. The primitive element theorem lets us turn all those algebraic numbers into one algebraic number. And then the last piece of the puzzle is the Frobenius density theorem, which is also called the Tevatarov density theorem. And this number theoretic tool gives us the primes that kind of take care of that last algebraic. And that's all I had to say. Thank you.